Just a quick warning that we're going to be talking about existentialism, lots of death, lots of falling, corruption, some stuff like that, being forgotten. So if you're not in the right headspace for that, skip these next few episodes.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of A Hopeless Endeavor, a Joanna Newsom podcast. My name is Sam.
My name is Nikki, and welcome to part seven?
It is. I just had to look on like my podcast app to see which one we put out last week. Yeah. Part seven.
Part seven of Sapokonikin.
I don't think, have we done seven parts of anything?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Kingfisher had seven parts, but not eight, I don't think. I think seven is our cap. I think
so. One of our friends in the Facebook group, Samir, asked me to send some notes to them from the first few episodes we did, and as I was reading through those yesterday, so like the episodes on Ys, and we only did two parts on Monkey and Bear, and that seems wrong to me now.
Dude, that seems so wrong to me now, too. And I had a crazy thought that we should go back and redo it, at least Emily.
That's so funny, because I sent in my email back to Samir, like, I think I need to go back and redo all of this. This is not enough. How did we only do two parts on Monkey and Bear?
And I don't know.
And Emily.
Yeah, let's just redo those.
Yeah, great. So endless content. Postponed. And we also, I was joking with Nikki, we also used to write scripts for these intros. Like, we had beautifully sourced documents for all of Ys, I think. And, like, color-coded intros for us to read. And that is just thrown out the window. Gone. for the better, so cute, I think. Though. It was really cute.
Like, now you say I'm Sam, and I say I'm Nikki, and then we'll say, well, we tried really hard, but we're bad at this, and
yeah,
it's a lot different now. Hopefully you guys are still with us. Thank you for being here, for those of you who are here for part motherfucking seven of this song.
Oh, Sapokonikin. We didn't say that.
Sapokonikin.
Did we say that? Yes. Maybe we didn't.
I don't know, but it is Sapokonikin. Yeah. We're going to try to finish it in today's recording session, which means that there are probably going to be at least two more episodes, potentially three. We'll see. But let's just get right into it so that we can tackle this beast of a song and then feel so accomplished.
Yeah. So yesterday, as I was just thinking about this song as a whole, I had a few bigger thoughts. And I think they're ones that we have addressed before, but like, I was sitting here and asking my partner like these bigger existential questions, like why do humans raise monuments, and like what gets called a monument, and why do some get kept and some not, and all of those things. So I don't know if we defined monument, but I really liked this Wikipedia definition on the etymology, which is, it is believed that the origin of the word monument comes from the Greek menosinon and the Latin monio, which means to remind, to advise, or to warn. Yeah, I liked all of those. It is also believed that the word monument originates from the Albanian word manimen, which in Albanian language means remember, suggesting a monument allows us to see past, to see the past, thus helping us visualize what is to come in the future. I just really liked all of that.
Yeah, it's very fitting with the themes that we've got going on here.
Yeah, and I like the idea that like all of the monuments that are represented in real life, at least on our timeline in this song, could be for any of those purposes, to remind, to advise, to warn, or simply to remember.
I'm super compelled by the warn one in particular. Like, it feels like Ozymandias in this context serves as a warning for, and like especially when we consider the other version of the Ozymandias poem, not by Shelley but by dude whose name I'm forgetting currently, the fuck is his name, the other guy who wrote,
scroll up, I know we have it here, the one I forgot thank to you. Include it will haunt me forever. Horace Smith,
thank you. Okay, so especially with the Horace Smith version of the poem, which we're going to get into a little bit when we get to, like, The Hunter 100 years from now. But, like, his poem is more situated in, like, the future. And so, like, we're supposed to imagine our own civilization as being so... Or, like, I think with both poems, we're supposed to imagine our own civilization as being really vulnerable to, like, the sands and powers of time in this way. But I think in the Horace Smith poem, it's particularly... a salient theme. Yeah, so I really like the idea of monuments as warnings.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
Okay.
Sorry, the recycling truck is going past. It's very slow and very loud.
That's okay. I can't hear it.
Okay, that's right good. Now. Yeah. That's good. Okay, do we dive right in?
Let's dive right in. Do you have the album... Okay.
I do.
Maybe I will ask you to read it, please.
Sure. I'm going to do this whole first. So we're officially in like the second half of the lyrics, at least how it's formatted in the lyric book from the vinyl.
Thank the Lord.
Praise be. So she sings. I fell. I tried to do well, but I won't be. Will you tell the one that I loved to remember and hold me? I call and call for the doctor, but the snow swallows me whole with old Flory Walker. And that's the first paragraph. And then a line by itself is, the event lives only in print.
Ooh, that's its own paragraph?
It's like its own line. And then we have the three little stars. And then the next part starts. The event is capitalized. Which I like because I feel like it ties it to the cause at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And can I ask, is there a period right after fell? Like, is it its own sentence?
Yes.
I fell. Interesting. I fell. That's so hard hitting.
Yeah.
Pun not intended.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Fascinating. So. Who the fuck is the I?
Mm-hmm.
Who fell and why? How did she fall?
Downward movement is literally my only note. That's one of the things in our list. What is the movement happening in this song? It's downward. I think we can safely say that.
So last recording we ended, last episode we ended with a conversation about like the garment workers who were like unionizing and then their building caught fire and they had to jump from the windows.
Mm-hmm.
So we were like just talking about that. So that's so fresh in my mind. The uprising, I think, of the 20,000 it was called.
Yes.
So there's that. And she's about to go on to describe John Perry Mitchell's fall.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a ton of falling, but I don't have a theory or a view on what point of view she's assuming when she's saying I here.
It's such an interesting use of tense here too. I fell, I tried to do well, but I won't be.
Mm-hmm.
So to me that projects towards the future. I won't be doing well in the future because I fell. Like that seems very clear cut. To me as well.
Like, I love that there are sort of like a double, there might be like a double meaning here to like the idea of falling. So we have like the falling of the women from the building. We have the falling of John Perry Mitchell, but we also have the falling of like Ozymandias, the statue and the monuments and this more metaphorical sense of falling, which is like to, you know, lose your power, I guess, right? Also, I think that I fell, describing someone as having fallen could also mean that they died, like fallen soldiers. So all of that might be going on here. And I love the play on words when she says, I tried to do well. So like she tried to do maybe like she tried to be okay, but she's not going to be because like there's this inevitable death coming that is coming for all of us. And like, it doesn't matter how hard you try or how much you call for the doctor. It's a coming.
Yeah. And then I guess my next question is like, what is doing well? What does it mean to do well? Again, yeah. I think of those garment workers, like I think from my perspective, doing well for them would be, you know, having the ability to leave the house and make your own income, right? Like it was, if I remember correctly, the majority of the workers who died were women, young women, mm-hmm. and their children who were working with them in that factory. So doing well was just being able to, you know, meet your basic needs in a way that wasn't harmful to others, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. I keep in my own head wanting to interpret the line as I tried to do good, mm-hmm. but I won't be like I tried to do good things and like be a morally, you know, upstanding person because mm-hmm. I was thinking like one thing that we'll go on to talk about, but about John Perry Mitchell, the boy mayor of New York City who falls from a plane, that he was really into dismantling the corruption of Tammany Hall. And so like regardless if we're the garment workers or if we're John Perry Mitchell or if we're some like third party, some narrator, maybe she's just like being herself or like, you know, whatever, like a character at present time singing about all of these people, that like no matter what perspective we assume that it could be that she tried to do good, but she says the word well, which means more like about how she's doing, I think, right? Rather than like the impact she's having. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think well to me means more like I had a task that I tried to do, I tried to accomplish, or I tried to meet a certain goal. I tried to please myself or someone else in some way.
Right. My task was life, and I tried to do it well.
God, for sure. For sure.
But I won't be. I love the I won't be. It's so, like, beautifully dark.
And I think you said this already, too, but I like the idea that this is just, like, a collective statement, too, right? Like, we've talked about, like you said, we've talked about the soldiers. We've talked about, we will talk about John Perry Mitchell. We've talked about the painters and all of this, all of the different narrators. And I think I tried to do well, but I won't be, is like such a staring up at the clouds, like moment of clarity for anyone who's on their way out.
Yeah. Sad.
It is. So, yeah. And so is will you tell the one that I love to remember and hold me? Like, yeah.
Is it love or loved?
Loved.
Loved. Will you tell the one that I loved? The past tense almost makes it seem like she's died already. Like, yeah. Or like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Will you tell the one that I loved to remember and hold me? And I think this one is less of like a physical hold my body and more of like a hold me in your memory.
Yeah, me too. To remember and hold me. I was reading the genius annotation for this and it was sort of saying like that this might be like compared / contrasted with the way that like Ozymandias, for instance, or like Ramses wanted to be remembered, or like the men in this story. They didn't talk about gender, but I'm just inserting that because of course I am. Where like they all wanted to be remembered in this like monument sort of way. And here she's sort of changing the narrative to say that like, look, what's important to me is that the people that I loved remember me. So not that like people in New York City walk by a monument of me, but rather that like the people that I actually knew and like could have an impact on in my day to day will remember and hold on to the memory of me or like the impact that I had on them or something like that.
And at like the very least, remember that I tried to do yeah. well.
Yeah, that's sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess also the will you tell the one that I loved? I mean, who's you, mm-hmm. first of all? And also like it to reinforce the idea that she might have died already is that like, why can't she just tell the ones that she loved?
Yeah.
Like she seems to already be on a different plane.
And it does make me think again of the workers in that building. You know, if the building's on fire and you're standing at the window, if there's someone in line behind you ready to jump, maybe that's something you would say to them.
Ugh, like, yes,
I'm going. I won't be doing anything after this. But
yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if it was snowing on that day. When did that happen? I wonder what the season was. That would just be a nice connection. I don't have an answer to that. I have 7,000 yeah. tabs open here. Yeah. Will I find it? I don't know.
Debatable. And then here, like, the I call and call for the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
What do you... Like, why is she calling for the doctor? Is she dead already? Is this more metaphorical and we need to be less literal asking these questions? I don't know.
I don't know, because then it changes our perspective of the loss that's happening here, right? Like if it's someone who's taking their last breaths and they're calling in the present for the doctor, that's different than someone who has already passed and I don't know, as their soul or whatever is leaving their body is trying to come back to earth somehow. I don't know.
Yeah. There's like this resistance to this like very futile resistance to dying, even though like it's for sure happening.
Yeah.
And the idea of calling and calling sort of reinforces that futility. Like I call and nothing happens, so I have to call more.
Yeah.
And it's also sort of just so sad, not sort of, just entirely so sad. The idea that like we're so desperate to not die that like we call and call for the doctor, like, please help me, please help me. Like, please don't let me die.
Yeah.
But the snow swallows me whole with old Flory Walker. Did you find some fascinating stuff on Flory Walker?
I have a few things that I liked. Most of them are from the Christopher Laws article on Cultured Arm, which is an absolute godsend.
Linked in the show notes.
Oh, thank you. So Christopher Laws was talking about... Let me open the actual article here. I'm just going to read this entire paragraph here. Themes of unrequited love and unrealized potential come to a head in the reference which Sapochnikov makes to Flory Walker. In 2006, the conservator Michael Verrill Cox began to restore Spring, a painting completed in 1890 by the Australian Impressionist author Streeton. As he worked over the canvas, Verrill Cox discovered that Streeton had scratched the name Flory Walker with a pin 3 times into the paint. He subsequently found the inscriptions "Flory is my sweetheart" and "Flory/Smike," invisible to the naked eye but discernible by microscope. An X-ray of Spring had already revealed the traces of a female nude, painted out as Streeton furnished his pastoral scene with male bathers. Taking on the mantle of detective work, Verrill Cox was able to tease the threads of a relationship between the struggling artist and the affluent Melbourne-based Walker family, whose youngest daughter was named Florence. Further inscriptions in pencil and paint suggest that Streeton was briefly infatuated with Flory, the potential subject of his art at a time when the female form was uncommon within the context of Australian landscape painting. Differences in age and class make it unlikely that Streeton ever consummated his desire for Flory Walker, but the records leave a gap as Streeton burned some of his letters before he died in 1943, while Florence gave away some of her own correspondence. Print throws up its hands and the event lies somewhere in the ether. He's also just an incredible writer, Christopher Law.
He's a really good writer, totally.
Yeah, so again, we have, as with the earlier lost paintings in the song, what I like to think of an intentional covering up of the female form and replacing it with a male form for many reasons, right? Like that it was just not a thing that people did, whether that was because they didn't want to see women in art or it was inappropriate or it just wasn't in fashion, or women were just not allowed in those spaces for, you know, the zillion reasons. Yeah,
and like there's this theme of like the love there too, like love being the thing that gets sort of like uncovered, or the actual most interesting part of this painting, or the actual most interesting, I don't know, thing that yeah, I don't know. I think that's so cute though. It's like such a like I'm doodling on my high school or my middle school notebook. The name of my crush. It's just like Flory Walker, just in pinpricks, is so cute.
Flory is a name I've never heard before either.
Me either. It's cool though.
It is. It's, yeah.
I think it might be short for Florence.
Yes, I think that's what they said, okay. That one of the daughter's names. It's just an interesting nickname.
It is totally an interesting nickname. I also thought it was really interesting that the painting is called Spring. Sure. I have no theory, but like just that it ties into our theme of seasons being cyclical coming up in this painting, in this song, sorry. Yeah, so that's really cool, I think. Also, the idea that snow swallows me whole. So I got this again from Genius, but someone on Genius said that the idea of snow serving as like a memory eraser, like a forgetting mechanism. I think the person on Genius said that it originated from T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, but whether it originated from there or not, I think is definitely a theme in The Wasteland. So I need to fucking go back and read The Wasteland and then do a bonus episode for our Patreon on Joanna themes in The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot, because I know that in Only Skin there's like the Wasteland references, and I remember having read it and thinking it was very Joanna-y. But the snow imagery, the snow theme from The Wasteland is, let me just see here. In the, like the very, very first part of the poem, Eliot writes, "Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers." So I don't know if that's a direct reference or not, but it's there.
I like the idea of forgetful snow. Again, downward movement is one of my few notes for this.
Totally.
But that snow is covering something, and we've talked so much about layers and things being buried. I think that's a really nice connection.
Yeah, and even the idea of like the tabula rasa, like the just clean slate that snow really does seem to provide, at least like shit's going on underneath it, but also there's like an almost literal white canvas when it smells like that.
So that was something that I read in I think it's a different, maybe it's the same Michael Hicks article that you referenced a few episodes ago. This one's called The Text Will Not Yield.
Yes. Yeah.
So they had said early European colonists sailing into the untraveled world saw the new continent as a tabula rasa, In tracing the history of a place, Newsom's poem is replete with white. Painter's canvas, paper, marble, snow. It tells how blank surfaces, as they did for tupliomaniacal conquistadors, beckon the creative hand. So there's a tension arising between the unmarked and the marker, which is really cool.
That's a super cool way of putting it. Yeah, yeah. The unmarked and the marker. Yeah, that's really cool. Well put, Michael Hicks.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great article too.
Yeah. And the event lives only in print. To me, this last line is just reinforcing the theme that we've been talking about over and over, which is just that, like, all of our little lives are forgotten, and like the only thing that endures are these like very distorted representations of what we were that like obviously don't give us the whole picture. It's just a description that like can get degraded over time.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. It also makes me think, we haven't really gotten into John Rory Mitchell yet, but in one of the articles that I read about him, there was a link to, was it like, of course I did. Oh, here it is. Yeah. To the New York Tribune, like the actual newspaper with the,
yeah.
Did you see that too?
Yeah. So cool. I mean, let's just get into it, unless you have other stuff to say about that.
No, first. Go for it. Tell me about him.
Okay. So should I read the lyrics first?
Oh, probably.
Okay. Does the, for you, the paragraph end at John's fall after he said?
No, it's all one long thing all the way to look in despair.
Oh, shit. All right. Okay, I can do it.
I know, it's the last one. It's long. It's
crazy. Many lines. Do you hear my dog losing his mind?
I do. What does he do?
I'm so sorry about that. I don't know. I don't know what he's doing. Sorry, everybody. I can do very little to make him be quiet once he starts barking, so I've just assumed the strategy of letting him do his thing.
Yeah. Who knows?
That's probably fine. We got a package, and he's losing his mind about that.
He's letting you know.
He's letting us know, yeah. Okay, so she sings and wrote, he said, it's all right and it's all no, let's try this again. Okay, so it goes. He said, it's all right and it's all over now, and boarded the plane. His belt unfastened, the boy was known to show unusual daring, and called a boy, this alderman, confounding Tammany Hall, in whose employ King Tamanend himself preceded John's fall. So we all raise a standard, to which the wise and honest soul may repair, to which a hunter, 100 years from now, may look in despair, and see with wonder the tributes we have left to rest in the park, swearing that our hair stood on end, to see John Perry Mitchell depart, for the Western Front, where our work might count, all exunt, all go out, await the hunter to decipher the stone and what lies under now. The city is gone. Look in despair. The end, I think, right?
Mm-hmm. I have two looks and despairs.
Two looks and despairs.
But you got it exactly. This is a sick verse. It's incredible. So and the way that she sings it, the way that it's like constantly winding up and letting go and winding up and letting go, and then we end with look in despair, kills me. If we haven't said
it
enough.
That's a really good way of describing it. The winding up and letting go, it really does feel like that. It's just like tension, and then the city's gone.
Yeah. If we haven't said it enough, she's incredible.
Yeah, this is a beautiful, and I love the way that the words feel coming out of your mouth too. It's just like very, it like flows really nicely.
It does. Yeah.
Okay, so in this verse, I was fascinated to find out that there are like direct quotes from that newspaper article that you're referencing. So did you want to go over some of them?
If you have them in front of you, go for it. I know that it's all right and it's all over now is one.
Yes. So I don't have it in front of me, but I will pull it up because it's
fascinating. Okay. I have some notes from, again, this is based on the New York Tribune article, which is from, oh crap, oh, here it is, Sunday, July 7th, 1918. And this is the Cultured Arm article reporting on that. So it says, the death of John Pori Mitchell was front page news. The New York Tribune account furnishes Sapochnikov with some of its most suggestive lines and keenest imagery. So the headline of the newspaper article was, Mitchell killed by fall from arrow, safety belt loose. The article notes that upon joining the aviation service, he was sent to San Diego, California, where, after successfully passing through the cadet training, he became a full-fledged flyer. He was frequently mentioned as having shown unusual daring. So that's another one.
Mm-hmm.
So we have... the Tribune piece adds that Michael was reaching the finishing stages of training necessary for service at the war front. On the moments prior to his fateful flight, the Tribune paints an intimate portrait. Mayor Mitchell and his instructor, Lieutenant John McCaffrey, went out to the grounds early this morning and were laughing and talking about New York City politics. Lieutenant McCaffrey jokingly remarked that he was sorry he did not vote for Mr. Mitchell in the last election. And Mayor Mitchell, as he climbed into his seat, smiling, replied, "That's all right. It's all over now." Literally.
So, yeah, my mind was blown by this. We have the "It's all right and it's all over now" direct quote from this newspaper. We have the belt unfastened, that he was showing unusual daring.
Mm-hmm.
We have him being called a boy. And something else? I don't know. Lots of shit, though, that is like a direct reference to that article, which I think is so cool because she's referencing not the event itself, but the printed version of the event, which goes hand in hand with the previous line, which is the event lives only in print. So she's like getting all of her knowledge. It's like playing telephone.
Yeah.
Like, you know?
Another one that's directly from there is "Where Work Might Count."
Oh, my God. Yes.
Mitchell reportedly chose the air service believing he could advance there more rapidly than in any other department. "My one wish," he said, "is to go over to the Western Front where work might count."
Ugh, dude, that, like, the phrasing of that breaks my fucking heart. Like,
yeah.
Isn't that so sad? The idea that, like, your work, like, all you want is to do something, to, like, serve in a way where your work could count. I don't know. That just, it kills me.
And sorry, you said a little bit about his earlier career. He was a politician in New York. He was the mayor.
Yes. And so, yeah, he was the mayor of New York City. He was, like, really young. So he was called the boy mayor. But right before this, or, like, not right before, I think maybe... I don't know how long before, but right before, no, sorry, I'll stop saying right. before he fell from a plane and died, he had lost his reelection. So he had been fighting to get rid of corruption in Tammany Hall. It was like one of the things that he was sort of known for, but he lost his reelection campaign. And so, yeah, I guess that's what he was responding to when he said, "It's all right, it's all over now." But obviously there's like a double meaning there because he's about to die. But I think in the actual article, he was just referring to the election being over. Obviously, though, here it feels like it's infused with more meaning than that.
It makes me think of that Simon and Garfunkel song, "The Only Living Boy in New York." Now I wonder if that's connected.
Ooh, I don't know that song.
Oh, I love Simon and Garfunkel. Loved.
I remember reading this Joanna interview where I don't remember if she had read it or if the interviewer had told her that before like the actual album was released, the song was released as a single, and someone had interpreted her singing that part as for the Western Front where I walk my cow.
Huh.
And Joanna was like, it's so wrong, me and my trusty cow. Like, okay. Yeah, where our work might count. Just the most heartbreaking lyric ever. And so obviously it's talking about going and fighting in the war in World War One. We're going to, like, I think, just jump all over with this verse because it's so long. But one of the things that I think is super interesting is that, so she says, like, we all raise a standard and we see with wonder the tributes we have left to rest in the park, swearing that our hair stood on end to see John Perry Mitchell depart for the Western Front. But I think another thing that's really interesting here is, like, I think she's touching on the theme of unreliability of how we remember history, because as we read, at least in that newspaper article, he wasn't on his way to the Western Front. He was just doing training still. So it was still just a training exercise that he was up in the Air Force. So the idea that, like, people swear that, like our hair stood on end to see this guy depart for the war when that's, like, never what happened, right? So whether these people are just, like, exaggerating or, like, trying to insert themselves into a historical event when they weren't actually there, or, like, whatever it is, it's incorrect information. So I just like that that's sort of a theme, another theme that's happening here.
What does it mean if your hair stands on end? Is it like you're excited or you're nervous or you're scared?
Yeah, I think all of the above.
Okay.
Like, yeah. I think it's like, you know, I had goosebumps when this was happening.
Yeah. I think it's so interesting how many times it's mentioned that his seatbelt was unfastened, because to me that seems like a small detail. Like, if his plane was going to crash anyway.
Oh my God, man. It didn't crash.
It didn't crash. He fell from the sky. He just fell out.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure it crashed after, but, like, it's because he went upside down. He just, like, fell, which is so
unusual
scary.
Unusual daring.
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense to me. Why wouldn't he? Was he the pilot?
Yeah, I think so. So, yeah, this is, now you're making me question.
Okay, so this is the Wikipedia. After failing to get reelected, Mitchell joined the Air Service as a flying cadet, completing training in San Diego and obtaining the rank of major. On the morning of July 6, 1918, when returning from a short military training flight to Gerstner Field near Lake Charles, Louisiana, his plane suddenly went into a nosedive, causing Mitchell to fall from his plane due to an unfastened seatbelt. It doesn't say if it crashed after or not. Well, was he the only?
Oh, I see. Was he the only pilot?
Yeah. A short training flight. Let me see the citations for this.
And, like, why did it start to nosedive? So we have both the plane diving and the guy diving. Like, did he do it on purpose?
Okay. I have to, like, zoom in so close. Did he do it on purpose? Here we go. Oh, yes. Okay. So here is the actual article from the New York Tribune.
Okay.
It says, Major John Perry Mitchell, former mayor of New York City and an officer in the aviation section, was killed instantly today when he fell 500 feet from a single-seater scout plane. An examination of the wrecked machine revealed that the safety belt was unfastened at the time of the accident, causing Major Mitchell to fall when the plane went into a nosedive. No detailed official version of the accident has been disclosed. Mayor Mitchell had been in the air about half an hour when he fell at 8:05 a.m. Gerstner Field, where the accident occurred, is 15 miles from Lake Charles. Major Mitchell, I keep wanting to call him Mayor, but he's Major now, was flying beyond the boundaries of the field, and only a few men witnessed the accident. After a search, the body was found in tall marsh grass, 1/2 mile south of the field. After Major Mitchell's fall, the plane had crashed to the ground some distance away. Other airmen said the fact that the machine was only 500 feet in the air indicated he had been about to effect a landing.
Okay.
Oh my God. His wife, Mrs. Mitchell, was at Gerstner Field, but did not witness the accident. Major Lucky of the medical department and two women acquaintances of Mrs. Mitchell broke the news to her. She bore the shock with fortitude. When Major Lucky said he had bad news to tell her, Mrs. Mitchell said, "Tell it all. Tell it all. I am prepared and can bear it." Asked whether the news bearers could perform any service for her, Mrs. Mitchell asked to be left alone for a time. Sorry, I didn't vote for you. That's all right. It's all over now. One of the mechanicians, it's an interesting word, had said a few days ago, "It makes my hair stand on end to see Major Mitchell fly. He takes so many risks and seems to think nothing of it."
Jesus. I love these direct references. It's so cool. So yeah. Okay. So he was trying to land. Instead, he was nosediving. Also, I was looking at this New York Times article where it's describing the incident, and some banker he had spoken to had said that the reason that he chose to join the Air Force is after he lost his reelection campaign was because he could advance in that field more quickly than others, and he wanted to go to the Western Front, which work could count. So the idea that he was, like, in a hurry to, like... He was in a hurry to go make his work count and to, like, go do meaningful work and maybe to be remembered for that, you know, and then was unable to land. Like, that caused his plane to dive down to the earth and for him to fall from the plane. I don't know if we should be inserting meaning into that or not, but.
He tried to do well.
He tried to do well. On his definition of what that means to do well, and it ended up causing him to die early, which is sort of ironic. Like I want to do work that'll count, that'll, like, endure after I'm dead. And then he dies, A, before he can do that work, and B, like, really prematurely, right? Like, he could have had a much bigger impact had he not died in training.
Why didn't he wear his seatbelt? That's what I'm stuck on. Like, if you're going to do all these loop-de-loops and all of these risky maneuvers while your wife is there, especially, I don't understand why you don't just wear your seatbelt.
I don't know either. I really don't know either. Toxic masculinity.
Maybe. He seems so, like... clear-headed, though. Like, I like this guy.
I know, me too. I like this guy too.
Which is rare for the, like, male identifying white man.
Yeah. Yes.
In her music especially, like, it's hard to not, you know, I'm thinking of Only Skin when I leave at the end of that song and I'm like, wah. I'm like, oh.
Like men. Fuck men forever. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, not this boy.
Not this boy. How old was he? Like, why?
Yeah.
Like, I wonder how much of it was, like, an infantilizing of him because he had such big ideas and such, like, a positive outlook and wanted to do more and wanted to do better, and how much of it was just because he was just a little guy.
Little nugget. This is a good question. So he was, when he died, he was only 38. So it's not a boy.
It's not a boy.
Yeah. And I love that she sort of calls that out here, right? And called a boy and then like contrasts it with this alderman. Like, he's not a boy. An alderman, I looked it up, but let me just re-look it up to give you guys the definition here in case anybody like me isn't sure. So it's an elected member of a municipal council, basically just like a politician.
It's something that, so I'm just looking through all of my Wikipedia pages open here. And something that I noticed in these newspaper articles after the fire, the Triangle Fire, is that all the bodies are covered with white sheets. I wonder if we can tie that to the snow somehow.
Interesting.
It's also so interesting that, like, there was a time when we published actual photos of dead bodies in the newspaper.
It's crazy that anybody used to ever do that.
Wow, this article is called The Worthless Fire Escape and the Death Trap Below It. So there was a fire escape, but it was so dangerous that it was useless.
Oh.
There's also a cartoon of, like, the owner of the building holding bags of money and holding the door closed as everyone tries to escape. Oy, okay, hopping all over the place.
In the Michael Hicks article, he makes an interesting note here where he says that it would be uncharacteristic of Joanna to lift lines from this newspaper about John Perry Mitchell's, he says, bold Ulyssean heroics without noticing the different brand of heroism that his wife, Mrs. Mitchell, displays. So in the article, again, as you had read, Sam, the wife bore the shock with fortitude. So the idea that she has her own brand because of her gender, she has her own brand of heroism.
Sure.
Thank you guys so much for listening to part 7 of Sapochnicon. It is the penultimate episode. We have one more coming your way next week, and then we will be moving on to leaving the city. We have a Patreon. It is patreon.com/ahopelessendeavor. It is linked in the show notes there. We have bonus episodes. You can find early releases. Check us out. We have an email address, ahopelessendeavor@gmail.com. We have a Facebook group, A Hopeless Endeavor, a Joanna Newsom podcast. We have an Instagram account that Sandra does a beautiful job of running. It is.
You did that so fast, like a robot. Have you been practicing?
No, it's my venti coffee, man.
It is A Hopeless Endeavor podcast. I would love if you followed us on Instagram. We just surpassed 420 followers, and I thought that was a lovely number of people to have in our little community. 438, in fact.
Wow, look at that. That's crazy.
Zooming through, picking you all up and bringing you along for the adventure. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.